Aldo Leopold was an American conservationist whose writings reflect on the relationship between humans and nature. Although he died in 1948, his environmental philosophies remain relevant today and serve as inspirations to help people reconnect with nature. Joining us to talk about Aldo Leopold is Kurt Meine. He's a biologist, biographer of Aldo Leopold, and editor of the Library of America's Aldo Leopold, The Essential Writings of a Visionary American Environmentalist. He's also on screen. He's got a new film about Aldo Leopold called Green Fire, Aldo Leopold and a Land Ethic for Our Time. Welcome to the program, Kurt.
Well, thank you very much, Mindy.
So the science of ecology was really just emerging in the 20th century, and Aldo Leopold, who came of age in the early 1900s, is often described as the father of environmental ethics. Tell us a little bit about why he's known as.
Sure. Yeah, it's always a kind of a shorthand term when you say they're the father or the mother of something. And of course, there's many other people involved. But Leopold came along at a time when he was able to make some very important and special contributions, and especially in that what you just mentioned, as the science of ecology was emerging and maturing, Leopold, as much as any person, understood how important this would be to our understanding of our interactions with the natural world and with the things we derive from it and how we do that. So in the 1930s and 40s, as he was in the peak of his career, he was the key translator in a way of that new scientific knowledge, helping not just his fellow professionals, but the general public to understand the significance of this really different new way of understanding how nature works.
Yeah, especially when you think about that, you know, he comes along and you know, he is able to articulate the importance of expanding our idea of human community to soils, water, plants, and animals, or collectively the land. Kind of a deep thinker, I would think.
Yeah, and yet it's common sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's embedded in cultural traditions that go back to ancient times and cultures all around the world. But this idea that we are part of a larger community of life and ethics flows from your definition of what a community is and how you should behave within it. And so Leopold did recognize that this new science also had importance and significance beyond the science itself, that it affected the way we had to think about our relationships to other people, to the rest of the world, to future generations, to the way we make our livings, to the way we care about the future.
So he believed in order for human civilization to thrive and continue, it must be based on a harmonious relationship to the land. This is something many of us understand today, but that was really novel for his time.
It was, and put yourself back into a century ago. And Leopold came from the American Midwest, so he was born and raised in an environment in which the engines of American development were really wreaking havoc at that time, with no sense of conservation, no movement yet to guide our economic energies. And so he was watching his Midwestern landscape being plowed up as the great Midwestern prairies were going under. The great forests of the North Country, the Northern Great Lakes, were being leveled in those 30 years between the Civil War and 1900. Waterfowl, other wildlife were being depleted, and Leopold really comes of age with the conservation movement a century ago.
Yeah, and you're talking about this, and this is sort of the beginning. We're looking, you know, at the ideas of John Muir and newly elected President Teddy Roosevelt. One of the only open fields to those interested in conservation was the U.S. Forest Service, relatively new itself, and Aldo Leopold started his career there, right? So tell us how his work with the Forest Service helped shape his environmental ethic.
Sure. Just a few words of background to help put it into context, because this is when Leopold, in fact, comes to New England. He leaves the Midwest as a young man to go to college, actually first to prep school in New Jersey and then on to Yale. And it was at Yale, which had just established the new, what was then called the Yale Forest School. It still exists as the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Leopold came there as one of its first students. Graduated in 1909 to join what was then the brand new U.S. Forest Service, traveling all the way across the country to Arizona, New Mexico. He would spend 15 years there and become an innovator in all kinds of different fields, interested in wildlife at a time when very few others were. In fact, the field of wildlife management didn't even exist yet. He was interested in the protection of wilderness, wild lands, and helped create the first wilderness area in the country. Watersheds, the function of water in our landscapes was really something he was fascinated by, and the importance of soil and water conservation. So these are all fields that had a technical dimension to them, obviously. You had to know your field biology and your statistics and everything else that goes with managing wisely. But he always understood that there was also something beyond just the numbers, that this was also fundamentally about our human relationships, again, to each other and to the natural systems. And so he began to write even as early as the 1920s about our moral responsibilities, again, to our neighbors, to our children, to our future generations, and ultimately and radically to other species and the systems themselves. And it would take decades, it would take 20 plus years for him to fully develop this idea of what he, in his maturity, came to call a land ethic. And that in itself becomes the foundation stone for the emerging field of environmental ethics, which would take another 4 or 5 decades and is ongoing now.
Really amazing, the foresight that he had. You know, when you think about that, I mean, this all makes sense to us now, but, you know, in the time for him to have these observations, really, really fascinating.
Yeah, well, again, he wasn't alone, but he had a particular set of influences and people and books, and he was a voracious reader. These field experiences and his own self-discipline and observing and making the most out of every experience he ever had in the field, which was also remarkable. He was outside all the time. But it's his family background, it's books he read, it's his formal education. But it was really fundamentally something that comes from within.
But
what really set him apart from others in his own time was this capacity to write. He really spent so much time with pen in hand, usually pencil, actually, because he's always revising, but really trying to articulate this, again, not just for his fellow professionals, but ultimately when he became an educator himself, recognizing that he had an obligation to try to communicate this to the broader general public who had to know this.
Right. So from, as you mentioned, he loved it to be outside. So from a very early age, he started observing the natural world. And he said he kept field journals complete with drawings. He wrote beautiful essays about how these experiences shaped his philosophy on the human place in nature. Many consider A Sand County Almanac a classic and one of the main literary influences on the modern environmental movement. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, he had always been a very active writer, and he was well known within his professional circles for his skill as a wordsman, words crafter. However, began to change in the 1930s. And put yourself back in those years, middle of the Depression and the Dust Bowl, World War II on the horizon. He really began to think more deeply about the significance of this new understanding that comes from ecology and how important this was, again, to professionals, but to citizens as well. He began to teach also, and so he had to communicate this to students who probably never heard the word ecology. This is in the 1930s.
Right, right.
So he began to write these essays in a very plain language, elegant, but also understandable. And he wrestled with this. But he began to write in this new voice, starting in the late 1930s, a much more poetic, lyrical voice than he had been publishing in his professional journals and so forth. And the response was immediate and enthusiastic from his colleagues. He says, gee, Aldo, you should write more like this. And so starting, well, it was pretty much over the last decade of his life, he continued to write, again, these more poetic essays that could explain these general concepts in meaningful terms for any reader. And one after another, he began to get these essays written and began to realize he had a potential for a collection. To make a long story short, he put together a manuscript. It was rejected 3 times, maybe 4 times.
Wow.
Before finally, 1 week before he died, in fact, he got a letter from Oxford University Press and said, we'd like to publish your essays. He never actually knew the title, Sand County Almanac. That title would become world famous in conservation circles. Leopold never even knew the title because he died before it was given that name. It was published a year after he died and had modest success, actually, in its first generation. But with the rise of the environmental movement in the 1960s and 70s, the new paperback editions would sell hundreds of thousands, even millions of copies.
So he was alive during a time when the landscape and the natural world were experiencing some pretty dramatic changes. We had urbanization, deforestation, the extinction of the iconic American species like the bison and the carrier pigeon. In many ways, the changes to the natural world he experienced are similar to changes that we see as a result of climate change. The natural environment is very different from what we know now. I mean, how much did he write about some of these changes that he saw and where we were headed?
Yeah, one of the reasons Leopold's writing tends to resonate still as strongly as it does even 80 years later is because he was always wrestling with those big questions and with the big picture of environmental change. Mm-hmm. And he understood that it was very complex, but that ultimately we had to face these things and that these big questions would challenge our own set of values and our own ethical systems, that we had to adapt to these new realities. So in his own time, as you say, it was these major continental forces of deforestation and soil erosion and extinction of species. And he, again, was witness to these. And he was not just witness, he was working very hard as a professional scientist and resource manager to change the ways that these fields operated in the world. And by his later years, his mature years, he did come to say, we need not just better technical tools. We always need that. We always need new understanding, new data, and we always need to adjust. However, without this shift in our set of values, without an expansion of the moral sphere in which we see ourselves living and operating, that we would never come to that healthier, what we would now call more sustainable way of living. And so he began that conversation, which continues to this day and will continue because the problems have now become global in scope. And yet they resonate right at home in every one of our communities.
It's interesting because we talk about his relevance today, and you can look back and say, why weren't we paying more attention? And it's almost like can we learn lessons from the past, you know, as we're looking at what's happening now?
Yes, my way of sometimes putting that is, well, we can look at the glass being half empty and say, geez, we haven't come very far. Or we can look at it as half full and say, well, we've come pretty far. I tend to look at it as the glass is always filling and emptying. Yes. It's always a waxing and waning. And we usually respond to crises.
Right.
Usually it's when something is visible or smellable.
Right.
Or
costable.
Exactly. Or otherwise directly affects us that we tend to respond. Leopold is saying, no, we can't afford that way of looking at these problems anymore, especially because they're so large in scale and so long-term that if we do not begin this cultural shift and revisit the values that drive our every decision, then we will find ourselves in those crises more and more. And that's not going to work anymore because they're too many. And they're all connecting. All our problems are connecting and compounding themselves, whether it's climate change or water issues or energy issues or economic realities and so forth. They're all part of one big problem now. And we have to respond to that problem, again, not just with technical solutions, but also with some discussion and dramatic shifts in the way we value things in the world.
Whenever we talk about climate change today, much of this discussion is about the economic impacts of reducing carbon emissions, and many argue the costs are just too great. How would Aldo Leopold respond to that, do you think?
Well, on that particular point, he was always questioning himself and his colleagues, again, how can we adjust the economic signals? Mm-hmm. Not according to any particular ideology. Leopold's fascinating to study because we tend to put people in their pigeonholes. You have to be this or that politically and economically, but he was quite open-minded. So he would look at the economic questions and ask, how can we shift our incentives and how we spread costs and benefits through our economic system? But he would go well beyond that to answer any of these questions. I'm often asked, what would Aldo say or do about this and that? And I say, I never answer that question because you never know what he would have said, but you know how he would have thought. And he would have said, I would presume, get the best science you can, first of all. And here we are in Woods Hole, which has done so much to provide information and data and knowledge to the world. So this is a fitting place to look at that question. But science can't answer these questions. It can give you the information, but it can't tell you what to do with it. That's where ethics has to kick in. That's where the discussion of how science is used, how it interacts with our economic system, and how that plays out in society and what it means for everybody in society, and even more, he would push it, what does it mean for future generations, and what does it mean for the rest of the community of life?
We're talking with Kurt Meine. He's the editor of the Library of America's Aldo Leopold, The Essential Writings of a Visionary American Environmentalist. We'll have more after a break.